Madam, just a few concerns before tonight's reading. Why is there a child loose in the library? When is she leaving, and why is she an obnoxious monster?
Well, thank you very much. A, there's a child here because she was accidentally released from a painting this morning when a youth spell went awry. And B, she's leaving as soon as I can find the right spell to safely put her back. And C, she's an obnoxious monster because she's 5-year-old me.
I'll get the net.
You will watch her and keep her entertained whilst I host the reading.
Are you sure you'd like a giant shape-shifting wolf in charge of the child version of yourself?
Well, we already know that I survived long enough to run this library and to give you a home. Now, she's very fast. She likes to hide, and I have given her a bag of your favorite treats, the bloody ones.
Oh, and a little madam...
Welcome to the reading room, my dear guests. How good of you to come to hear a story on this beautiful, gloomy night. Please make yourself comfortable in any seat you like. We've put some extra pillows in the window seats and some large pillows on the floor in front of the fireplaces. What's that? What are they stuffed with? Oh, I couldn't tell you what Aunt Hilda's pillow stuffing recipe was. I swore that I wouldn't. I'm your mistress of the Midnight Library, Miranda Merrick. But you knew I was going to say that, didn't you? It seems some people are just gifted with knowing little bits of the future, or sometimes even major happenings are predicted that actually come to pass. Most of the time, though, life just comes at you blindly at breakneck speed, and before you know it, your neck is broken. Sadly, most predictions never happen. Regular humans just aren't that good at predicting the future. Almost 2 centuries ago, my great-great-grandmother, Annie, once predicted that a family of witches would secretly run this village and control the lives of its inhabitants. And that hasn't happened, has it? Although she was right about both world wars and that goat becoming mayor here in 1930, and about me hosting... those British Loremen fellows. And about Mr. Darling... Oh, I am sorry. I don't want to digress into memories about another beloved relative of mine, no matter how skilled she is. Is. My ramblings are fortuitous in one light, though, as tonight's reading is on the fascinating subject of the art of prediction and predestination. There are simply countless examples of such happenings down through time, the world over. Nearly every holy book and ancient writing contains some, mostly generalized statements, that predict the future state of humanity in some aspect or another, usually in a catastrophic way. There are hardly any predictions of peaceable Edens, I'm afraid. I myself have only a few hundred little visions and dreams written in a few journals that I've kept myself since I was able to write from about the age of 5. One silly one I will share with you was seeing myself as a tiny girl being chased through this very library by a huge, I thought, mythical man-wolf thing that fell easily under my command. Isn't that wild? In the vision, he did teach me to read and write in one sitting, though. Just thinking for a moment. Wow. No. I'm fine. Well, while I'm happy and honored to share with you several instances of accurately spoken foretellings of some horrible happenings, I will not bore you with the mountain of philosophical moanings on the subject of free will versus predestination, as I don't believe either camp could ever be declared right. I feel I can accurately predict that it's simply not ever going to be known. Were you always going to have that misspelled tattoo in that unfortunate spot? Were you certain from birth to nearly mature, get drunk and ask your own sister to marry you on stage at your prom? Or could you have chosen to do things more coherently in life? Who can say? It is uncanny how some famous people have precisely predicted amazing things, specifically their own deaths, which I am fairly well eager to expound on for you. After I relay the few we've found to be most compelling, I have saved the last example as a kind of dessert, as it deliciously is the telling of the deceased's corpse taking on a whole new life far into the future, and was eerily described in the famous Book of the Dead, the Egyptian holy funerary text from 2400 BC. This first prediction is from a literary favorite of millions of people, and ours too, Mark Twain, famous American author and humorist. You probably know he was best beloved for his plain-spoken logic and sharp wit, and his gift for portraying vivid characters in colorful settings, such as Huckleberry Finn and life along the Mississippi River in the 1800s. He had multiple careers in his life, once being a printer's devil, a riverboat pilot, a silver miner, a Confederate militiaman in the Civil War for a short time, and then a newspaper reporter and journalist, before becoming the prolific author he was destined to become. But what you may not know is that Mark Twain nearly wasn't at all. Born a full 2 months premature in the year 1835, he was not expected to live. Just think, we wouldn't have the treasured anthology of his 19 published books, numerous short stories and articles and speeches, or the joy of knowing the tales of Tom Sawyer, The Prince and the Pauper, and one of the first well-known examples of time travel in a major literary work, A Connecticut Yankee in King Arthur's Court. If he hadn't lived, I wonder just who instead of him would have become known as the father of American literature. Twain was a champion of literacy during a time when education wasn't mandatory across the United States. He was quoted to say, "The man who does not read good books has no advantage over the man who cannot read." We couldn't agree more. And although he had little faith in fortune tellers, notably quipping that prediction is difficult, particularly when it involves the future, he accurately predicted his own death in typical Mark Twain fashion. Speaking in regards to Halley's Comet being present in the night sky at the date of his birth in November of 1835, Twain's written statement was that the Almighty has said no doubt. Now, here are these two unaccountable freaks. They came in together. They must go out together. I came in with Halley's Comet in 1835, and it is coming again next year, and I expect to go out with it. On the day after the comet made its closest approach crossing the face of the earth on April 21st, 1910, Mark Twain died. The comet passed over the heavens, taking Twain with it. Tonight's reading at the Midnight Library is proudly brought to you by the League of Lady Gravediggers. If you have the gift of knowing just when you'll bite the dust, the League of Lady Gravediggers are the gals that you can trust. If you know the day you're going to be making your last sound, the ladies can even catch you before you hit the ground. And you'll want something special, not just any graveyard plot. The League of Lady Gravediggers know every unique spot. Away in a misty woodland, or perhaps a swamp or cave, the ladies know the good land and keep the secret of your grave. You'll be buried deep with reverence, the location known to none. 'Cause the League of Lady Gravediggers have the dirt on everyone. Our next grave foretelling is fairly well known, but is such a chilling tale and of someone so dear to us that we couldn't fathom not sharing it with you, our dear guests. It is the woe-filled story of President Lincoln's death vision. President Lincoln, as some of you will know from past readings, is a beloved character among all of us here in the Midnight Library. I have no reservations about telling you that even when I was a child, I had a natural and early fascination with him, to the point of collecting pictures of him that I insisted be hung on the walls of my room. He seemed to have the presence of a wise and protective uncle to me, somehow. One comforting trait that I apparently share with the great man is a deep and profound respect for the happenings in the mysterious realms of the unconscious mind. I am endlessly enthralled with the world of dreams. Abraham Lincoln, from early in his life and throughout his adult life, was reportedly compelled to contemplate and examine closely the dreams that came to him each night as he slept. An exemplary proof of this can be found in a preserved letter from 1863 that the president wrote to his wife, Mary. In it, he writes of a precautionary measure regarding their young son, Tad, exclaiming that she had better put Tad's pistol away, as he had had an ugly dream about him, and he obviously feared that the incident would make its way into reality. It's foreboding also in that it's twinned with Lincoln's own fate. Another intriguing example of his fixation with dreams can be found in the telling of how, on the morning of the day of his assassination, the president told his staff of a vivid dream he'd had, of traveling at great speed across a body of unknown waters. He confided to them that he had had this same exact dream each time before every momentous point that took place during the war. It may interest you that water, when presented in dreams, is the symbol of life. I would like to say here that even if you've never entertained the idea in the slightest, that you may like to, perhaps, consider beginning a dream journal to take note of the themes and symbology and emotional standings that present themselves to you in various forms in this oh-so-private state of consciousness. What your quiet inner mind whispers to your sleeping mind can teach you things about yourself that no waking experience can. Trust me, I once saw myself in a dream, speaking aloud to countless faces whom I did not know, but felt a true depth of affection for. And here we are. A few lesser-known facts about our dear president are that he was only 56 years old when his life was taken from him. It's fairly well known that presidents in general tend to age rather quickly, as the weight of a nation actually does bear down heavily upon them. But when that nation is at war with itself, well, you can see for yourself in comparative photos of Mr. Lincoln of when he first took office in March of 1861 to then how literally war-torn he looks just 4 years later. The difference is striking. Another fact that is often overlooked regarding the time of his assassination was that the war was over by just 5 days. On April 9, 1865, General Robert E. Lee surrendered to General Ulysses S. Grant. This act ended the 4-year-long war. Lincoln had preserved the Union of the United States that stand together today. The president was also just 42 days into his second term. What I'm going to share with you now is a direct account taken down by Ward H. Lehman, Mr. Lincoln's friend and self-appointed bodyguard when they happened to be together out in public. Mr. Lincoln said, "About 10 days ago, I retired very late. I had been up waiting for important dispatches from the front. I could not have been long in bed when I fell into a slumber, for I was weary. I soon began to dream. There seemed to be a death-like stillness about me. Then I heard subdued sobs as if a number of people were weeping. I thought I left my bed and wandered downstairs. There the silence was broken by the same pitiful sobbing, but the mourners were invisible. I went from room to room. No living person was in sight, but the same mournful sounds of distress met me as I passed along. I saw light in all of the rooms, and every object was familiar to me. But where were all the people who were grieving as if their hearts would break? I was puzzled and alarmed. What could be the meaning of all of this? Determined to find the cause of the state of things so mysterious and so shocking, I kept on until I arrived in the East Room, which I entered. There I met with a sickening surprise. Before me was a catafalque, on which rested a corpse wrapped in funeral vestments. Around it were stationed soldiers who were acting as guards, and there was a throng of people gazing mournfully upon the corpse, whose face was covered, others weeping pitifully. 'Who is dead in the White House?' I demanded of one of the soldiers. 'The president,' was his answer. 'He was killed by an assassin.' Then came a loud burst of grief from the crowd, which woke me from my dream. I slept no more that night, and although it was only a dream, I've been strangely annoyed by it ever since." On the evening of April 14, 1865, President Abraham Lincoln was killed by his assassin's bullet. 4 days later, his body would lie in state in the White House to the sound of constant sobbing from the mourners. His dream vision now made manifest. 3,500 people per hour shuffled past the open casket to gaze upon the dear man's countenance. It's estimated that 40,000 people paid their respects to the beloved president in the days his body was in the White House. Untold millions were said to attend the passing of his funeral train as it made its way through 180 cities on its way across 7 states to his home state of Illinois. But it's estimated that as many as 31 million people across the United States participated in various funeral memorial gatherings that were held countrywide in his fine honor. Now, enough of this beautiful sadness. Let's dig into that dessert I promised you. Our first two souls who smoothly predicted their own demise were wonderfully woeful, but the story of our next person, who was discovered thousands of miles away from their homeland and thousands of years after their burial, takes the proverbial soul cake. and their story can be eerily punctuated by excerpts from the holy book of their homeland, the ancient Egyptian Book of the Dead. In the mid-1800s, travel across the United States was a treacherous adventure to partake of, and motor cars were not yet featured, but horseback, horse coach, and locomotive trains were. When people finally arrived at a coveted destination, after often taking a physical beating by utilizing such rough modes of travel, they expected wondrous things to happen there. And those in business of hosting these far-flung visitors were determined to dazzle their patrons with any spectacles and creature comforts they could come up with. In the state of New York, Niagara Falls was one such site. In addition to having the glorious natural wonder of the magnificent falls, there were also grand hotels, restaurants, shops, and museums. Well, there were the start of all future modern museums, a collection of curiosities. In the mid-19th century, Egyptian mummies were the talk of the modern world. Everyone was fascinated with them. You could even arrange to buy them if you knew just whom to get in touch with. In the mid-1850s, the Niagara Falls Museum hired Dr. James Douglas to purchase a collection of mummies and coffins to put on display to reel in their hungry-eyed tourists and to keep them in town a little longer. The small group of mummies, one of which was of unknown importance, and their mix of gravely goods were loaded upon the modern shipping vessel of the day, likely a resplendent clipper ship, which began its journey west. And this is curious because in the ancient Egyptians' Book of the Dead, west is the direction the sacred text stated the soul, and most certainly a soul of royal lineage, would be destined to travel en route to its next life. Westward, westward to the land of the just. I am a spirit body. I am a spirit soul. The mummies were a huge draw for the collection of oddities, along with other startling treats for the eye, such as taxidermied exotic animals like two-headed cows, birds from the Amazon, and mastodon teeth, and later a well-preserved skeleton of a humpback whale. For over 100 years, thousands visited the strange museum. It wasn't until 1966 that some keen-eyed visitor noticed that one of the mummies was not like the others. This mummy was better preserved, and its arms were crossed over its chest. At first, the mummy was thought to be Queen Nefertiti, but closer inspection showed that this mummy was a daddy. Most definitely male, but only royal mummies were buried with their arms in this unique ceremonial pose, just like this one. By the late 1900s, far better testing had been developed, and the mummy was on the move again, this time to face a kind of judgment. He was crated up and taken across the U.S. highway system. This, too, was also foretold in the Book of the Dead. Fleeter than greyhounds, quicker than a shadow, I have traveled the earth. I come to you without a witness against me. After undergoing CT scans and MRIs and carbon-14 dating tests, and comparative x-rays between the mummy and several proposed royal relatives, he was found to be none other than Ramses I, founding pharaoh of the ancient Egyptians' 19th dynasty, whose reign began in the year 1290 BC. His royal mummy is more than 3,000 years old, and had lain unidentified and uncared for in a dusty, people-trodden curiosity museum at Niagara Falls for 138 years. After the turn of this century, the curators of the much more modern museum that housed the fine pharaoh decided it was time for Ramses to return to his beloved homeland of Egypt to finally get his eternal rest. This time, the royal mummy received the royal treatment. He was cautiously wrapped in protective packing and gently placed aboard an airliner for his flight to Egypt. The plane lifts him high into the heavens. The sacred funerary text reads thusly: I have risen up out of the chamber. I fly. I alight like a hawk. The gods have heard my name. It would seem some old religious books could be interpreted as quite accurate after all. One final note we found to be especially enthralling was the fact that Mark Twain and President Lincoln both visited the Niagara Falls Museum and may have both cast their eyes upon the unknown pharaoh. They signed the museum's guestbook, and we would only be too happy to have you sign our guestbook as you follow the cordoned-off carpet to our front desk. We kindly ask that you please resist the urge to turn the pages to spy on the signatures of past guests in order to protect their privacy. And please ignore the curious, almost childlike markings made by, we're not sure who. They're certainly not practice curses, that we know for certain. Good night, my dear guests, and thank you for visiting the Midnight Library. Mr. Darling, thank you so much for looking after her, me, during tonight's reading. Was I very much trouble for you? This is so odd.
Madam, you were she's been a delight. Such a bright child. We squirreled ourselves away with a few books and writing paper. And do you know that she picked up both skills almost immediately?
Yes, I remember. I mean, I'm aware. Are you aware that you have bright fuchsia ribbons tied to your ears and tail?
Do I? Well, she began petting me and I fell soundly asleep. She sang a little song. Hush, little wolf man, don't be so contrary. I have a home for you.
In the Midnight Library. Good night, Mr. Darling.
Good night, madam.
The Midnight Library is proudly brought to you by Miranda Merrick and everyone at Astonishing Legends. Sound design is by Chris at Sounds Like an Earful. A good library always needs good-hearted patrons. Please visit patreon.com/midnightlibrary. And for a bit more fun, we've added the League of Lady Gravediggers merch to our online Redbubble shop.